We usually start these deep dives with, well, a pretty massive stack of material.
Oh, yeah. Usually it's like huge research papers or investigative article.
Right.
Or sometimes an entire nonfiction book that we've promised to distill down for you. But today, you sent us something that completely breaks the mold.
It really does. It's definitely not a stack.
No, it's a single sheet of paper. And honestly, looking at it, I kind of thought there had been a printing error.
I mean, it definitely looks like a mistake at first glance, right?
Yeah.
It just completely challenges the basic expectation of what an educational source is even supposed to be.
Right. Because, well, here is exactly what's printed on this single piece of paper you sent us. At the top, there's a header that says, excerpts from How Lasers Work.
Just that one line?
Yeah. And then right below that, the actual excerpt is just the title again, How Lasers Work.
That's it.
That's literally it. Six words. Excerpts from How Lasers Work. How lasers work.
It's the absolute definition of a minimalist document.
Okay, so let's unpack this because it feels like a prank.
A little bit, yeah.
It's like walking into a fancy restaurant, sitting down, and the waiter hands you this beautiful leather-bound menu.
Right.
You open it up, you're ready to read about the steaks and the seasonal vegetables, and printed right in the middle of the blank page is just the word food.
Just food. That's a great analogy.
So how do we even begin to analyze a source that announces its topic but provides absolutely zero mechanics? I mean, are we just looking at the cover of a missing book?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the document, in its extreme brevity, it kind of acts as a pure declaration of intent.
Okay, how so?
It strips away all the preliminary throat clearing that usually accompanies a textbook. It just presents a singular focus. Even without the underlying physics, the text, How Lasers Work, establishes a definitive educational premise.
So it's telling us what we're supposed to learn, even if it doesn't teach it.
Exactly. It tells us exactly what the missing information is meant to achieve, which is demystifying a specific technology.
But it doesn't actually demystify anything. It just, like, points at the mystery.
It does, yeah. And honestly, sometimes identifying the boundary of your own ignorance is the most important first step.
Okay, that's fair.
The phrase, how something works, is a promise. It says, you know, you currently look at this technology as a black box, and the goal is to break that box open.
Right.
So by providing only the title, the source distills the entire educational endeavor down to the identification of a gap in your knowledge.
Which is a really interesting feeling, because I see lasers all the time.
Oh, everywhere. Check out scanners, laser pointers.
Barcode readers. Exactly. I just accept them as background reality. But staring at this piece of paper, I'm basically forced to admit that if you ask me to actually explain the physics of a laser pointer to a five-year-old, I would completely freeze up.
Most people would. The title creates an intellectual vacuum. When confronted with a clearly labeled gap in understanding, our natural inclination is to want to fill it.
We hate the vacuum.
We really do. If the document had just dumped the physics on you immediately, you might have skimmed it, right?
Probably.
But by withholding the information, it forces you to consciously acknowledge the gap before you even attempt to cross it.
It makes you hyper aware of what you don't know. Which I think brings us to the weirdest part of the paper, which is the framing. The source explicitly calls itself excerpts, plural.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the very presence of the word excerpts guarantees that a larger, comprehensive body of text exists out there somewhere.
Because you can't have an excerpt of nothing.
Exactly. An excerpt cannot exist in isolation. It's a fragment cut from a larger whole.
So what does this all mean for us? Is the author playing a trick on us, or is this just a placeholder, like a signpost pointing to the knowledge we're supposed to go find ourselves?
Well, think about the era we live in right now. We are dealing with severe information overload.
Oh, for sure.
So providing only a title might actually be the ultimate way to avoid overwhelming the reader. It forces you to acknowledge a specific topic without demanding you immediately process, like, dense scientific data.
So it's a gentle tap on the shoulder instead of a fire hose to the face.
That's a perfect way to put it, yeah.
Okay, well, I appreciate the gentle tap. And I appreciate the profound minimalist philosophy of this six-word document. But I'm not going to sit here for an hour analyzing the ontological weight of a blank page.
I wouldn't blame you.
The title promised to explain how lasers work. The curator left us hanging, so I guess we have to do the heavy listing today.
I think we have to.
We're going to fulfill the promise of the excerpts right now.
I think that's the only logical next step, honestly. The document challenged us to seek the answers, so let's seek them.
Let's actually break open the black box. So where do we even start? I know LASER is an acronym. Let's just start there. What does it stand for? And how does that give us a roadmap for the mechanics?
Okay, so laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
That's the one.
Okay, light and amplification I get. Radiation sounds scary, but I assume we just mean radiating light, not like nuclear fallout.
Correct. In physics, radiation just means the emission of energy as electromagnetic waves or moving subatomic particles.
Okay.
Visible light is a form of electromagnetic radiation. Heat radiating from a stove is radiation. It doesn't mean it's radioactive or dangerous in the nuclear sense.
Good to know, because that word always puts me on edge. But it's those middle words, stimulated emission, that sound like the actual secret sauce here.
They absolutely are.
But before we get to the stimulated part,
right,
we probably need to talk about light itself, right? Like,
yeah,
how is the light coming out of a laser pointer fundamentally different from the light coming out of, say, the flashlight on my phone?
So, to understand the difference, you really need to understand how light behaves. Your phone's flashlight, or just a standard light bulb, produces what we call incoherent light.
Incoherent, like a bad argument.
Similar concept, actually. Incoherent light is just chaotic.
Chaotic how?
Well, a light bulb generates light by heating up a filament until it glows, or by exciting gas randomly. It's throwing out photons, which are the fundamental particles of light, in every conceivable direction.
Just a total spray of photons.
Exactly. And not only are they going in all directions, but they are also a huge mix of different wavelengths, which means a mix of different colors.
Right, because white light from a bulb is just all the colors of the rainbow smashed together.
Precisely. And furthermore, the light waves are completely out of phase with one another.
Out of phase.
Yeah, imagine a wave pool at a water park where 100 different kids are jumping in at totally random times.
Oh, I've been in that pool. It's a mess.
Right, you get a choppy, chaotic, messy surface. The peaks of some waves cancel out the troughs of other waves. That is incoherent light. It's scattered, it's mixed, and it diffuses very quickly over distance.
Which is exactly why a flashlight beam gets wide and dim the further away you point it. It just spreads out.
Exactly. A laser, on the other hand, produces coherent light. It is highly organized.
Okay, what makes it organized?
First, it is monochromatic. Mono meaning one, chroma meaning color. A laser beam consists of one single, highly specific wavelength of light.
So if it's a red laser, it's purely red. There's no rogue blue or green photons mixed in there at all.
Just one pure wavelength. Second, it is highly directional. The photons are all traveling in exactly the same direction, tightly parallel to one another.
So they don't spread out.
Right. And third, and this is the true definition of coherence, the waves are all perfectly in phase.
In phase, meaning the peaks and the valleys, the actual light waves line up perfectly?
Yes. Back to the wave pool analogy. Instead of 100 kids jumping in randomly, imagine a massive mechanical paddle that pushes the water all at once.
Like the ones they use for surfing pools.
Exactly. Every single wave crests at the exact same moment and hits the trough at the exact same moment. Because they are in phase, their amplitudes actually add together. They reinforce each other, creating a much more powerful, focused wave.
Okay, so a light bulb is a chaotic crowd of people walking in different directions, bumping into each other. But a laser is a military parade.
That's a great visual.
Everyone marching in perfect lockstep, wearing the same uniform, heading in the exact same direction.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. So the real question becomes, how do you get nature, which usually prefers chaos and randomness, to organize light into a perfect synchronized marching band?
Right, because if I just heat something up, like we said, it glows randomly. How do we actually force the order? I'm guessing this brings us down to the atomic level.
It does. We have to look at the atoms themselves, specifically the electrons orbiting the nucleus of the atoms. This takes us way back to Niels Bohr and his model of the atom from the early 20th century.
Oh, man. The classic diagram we all saw in high school chemistry. The nucleus in the middle and the electrons spinning around it on little tracks like planets around the sun.
Right, the planetary model. While quantum mechanics has shown that model is a bit of an oversimplification, it's actually still the best conceptual tool for understanding lasers.
Okay, so how does it work for this?
In this model, electrons don't just orbit anywhere they please. They are restricted to specific, fixed orbits, which we call energy levels or energy states.
Meaning they are quantized. They can be on step one of the ladder or step two of the ladder, but they cannot just hover in the air between the steps.
Exactly. And nature is fundamentally lazy. It always seeks the lowest possible energy state.
Relatable.
Very. So under normal conditions, the electrons in an atom are hanging out in the lowest available orbit, closest to the nucleus. We call this the ground state.
The ground state. Electrons just chilling on the couch.
But if you pump energy into that atom, let's say you flash a really bright light at it or run an electrical current through it, an electron can actually absorb that energy.
What happens then?
When it absorbs energy, it gets excited and jumps up to a higher orbit, a higher energy state.
He jumps out a rung on the ladder.
Yes, but remember, nature is lazy. The electron doesn't want to stay in that excited, high energy state. It's unstable up there.
Right. It takes effort to hold on.
It's like holding a heavy weight above your head. Eventually, you're going to drop it. So, after a tiny fraction of a second, the electron spontaneously drops back down to the ground state.
And energy has to be conserved, right? It can't just disappear. So when the electron drops back down, where does that extra energy go?
It releases it in the form of a photon, a tiny packet of light.
Ah, so that's where the light comes from. The electrons jumping down from the upper rungs of the ladder.
Exactly. This process is called spontaneous emission. It happens all around us.
Like where?
Well, when a neon sign glows, it's because electricity is forcing the electrons in the neon gas up to a high energy state, and they are spontaneously dropping back down, spitting out photons of red light in random directions at random times.
Okay, so spontaneous emission gets us light, but it gets us the chaotic, disorganized light bulb light, the kids jumping in the pool randomly.
Right, because every atom in that neon tube is acting independently. The electrons drop whenever they feel like it, firing photons in every direction. To get a laser, we need synchronization. We need something more than just spontaneous emission.
We need the S in laser.
Stimulated emission.
Right. So how does that work?
Well, for this, we actually owe a massive debt to Albert Einstein.
Why Einstein? Seriously, I always associate him with relativity, EMC, or black holes. He worked on lasers.
Well, he didn't build a laser, but in 1917, he published a paper on the quantum theory of radiation where he theoretically predicted the process of stimulated emission.
In 1917.
Yeah, he mathematically proved that there had to be another way for an atom to release a photon.
Okay, so how does Einstein's version work?
Imagine you have an atom where the electron is already in an excited state. It's sitting up there on the higher rung, hanging on, getting ready to spontaneously drop.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Now imagine a stray photon comes flying along, and this photon happens to have the exact same amount of energy as the difference between the electron's excited state and its ground state.
So an incoming photon approaches an already excited atom.
Right. When that specific incoming photon interacts with the excited electron, it doesn't just bounce off, it actually stimulates the electron, forcing it to drop to the ground state right then and there.
It basically knocks it off the ladder.
Essentially, yes. And when that electron drops, what does it do? It emits a photon to shed its excess energy.
But wait, now we have two photons. We have the original one that came flying in and the new one that the electron just spit out.
Exactly. But here is the magic, the true miracle of quantum mechanics that makes lasers possible. That new photon is an exact, perfect clone of the original photon.
Wait, a perfect clone?
A perfect clone. It has the exact same wavelength, it travels in the exact same direction, and its waves are perfectly in phase with the original photon.
Wow.
It's as if the first photon recruited a partner, and now they are marching side by side in perfect lockstep.
That is wild. So one photon goes in, hits an excited atom, and two identical synchronized photons come out.
That is stimulated emission.
I see where this is going now. Because if you have those two cloned photons marching along and they run into two more excited atoms.
They stimulate those atoms to drop, and now you have four perfect clone photons. Then those four hit four more excited atoms, and you have eight. Then 16, 32, 64.
That's a chain reaction.
An optical avalanche.
The marching band is recruiting more members at exponential speed, and everyone is perfectly in step. So this is the light amplification part of the acronym.
You've got it. That avalanche of identical, perfectly in-phase photons is the laser beam.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But let me push back for a second here.
Sure.
If stimulated emission is a fundamental law of physics predicted by Einstein way back in 1917, why aren't lasers just happening naturally all the time? Why doesn't a campfire suddenly turn into a laser beam?
That is the crucial question, and it's why it took over 40 years from Einstein's theory to the invention of the first working laser.
40 years.
Yeah. The roadblock is something called a population inversion.
Population inversion.
Yeah.
Sounds like a demographic crisis.
It's a statistical problem, really, at the atomic level. Remember when I said nature is lazy and most electrons want to be in the ground state?
Right. They prefer the couch.
Well, if you shine light through a normal chunk of material, a photon is far more likely to hit an atom that is in the ground state. When a photon hits a ground state atom, the atom just absorbs the photon, using its energy to jump up to the excited state. The photon is destroyed.
Ah, so normal matter acts like a sponge for light, not an amplifier. The photons just get eaten up by the lazy atoms.
Exactly. Absorption dominates. If you have 100 atoms, 99 of them are usually in the ground state, and maybe one is randomly excited.
So if you send a photon in, it's going to get absorbed long before it finds that one excited atom to trigger a stimulated emission.
The avalanche gets stopped before it can even start.
So to create a laser, you have to somehow invert that natural population.
Yes. You need to create an artificial situation where there are more atoms in the excited state than in the ground state. You need to push the majority of the electrons up the ladder and hold them there so that when a photon comes along, it encounters a target-rich environment for stimulated emission.
So you basically have to pump a massive amount of energy into the system all at once to get everyone excited simultaneously.
That's it, exactly. That energy source is called the pump. It can be a massive flash of intense white light, an electrical discharge, or even chemical reactions.
And its only job is to create that inversion.
The pump's entire job is to violently force the atoms out of their lazy ground state into the excited state, creating the population inversion.
Okay, so let's walk through the actual physical anatomy of a laser device then. We have the pump to provide the energy. What else do we actually need?
You need a gain medium. This is the actual material containing the atoms you are going to excite. It's the battleground where the avalanche happened.
What kind of material works for a gain medium? Can it be just anything?
In theory, yes. There's actually a famous joke among physicists that you can make a laser out of anything if you pump it hard enough, including a block of Jell-O.
Wait, really? Jell-O?
Yeah, and they actually have made edible lasers out of gelatin.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
Edible laser.
It is. But practically, you need a material with a very specific atomic structure that allows electrons to stay in a slightly prolonged excited state, which is called a metastable state.
Why does it need to be prolonged?
Because if they drop down too fast, you just can't build up the population inversion. You can't get enough of them up the ladder at the same time.
So they had to hang on that upper ladder rung just a fraction of a second longer than normal, just waiting for the avalanche to hit them.
Exactly. Common gain mediums include certain types of crystals, like ruby, or gases, like a mixture of helium and neon, or semiconductors like gallium arsenide.
Okay, so we have the gain medium, let's say a cylinder of ruby crystal, and we have the pump, maybe like a spiral-shaped flash tube wrapped around the ruby to blast it with light.
Right.
We pump the energy in, the electrons jump up, we have a population inversion, the avalanche starts, but wait.
What's the problem?
The atoms in the crystal are facing all different directions, right? If a random spontaneous emission kicks off the avalanche, weren't the photons just cascade sideways and shoot out the sides of the ruby cylinder?
They absolutely will. And that is exactly why the third crucial component of a laser is required, which is the optical cavity or the resonator.
The optical cavity. What is that?
Mirrors. It's essentially two mirrors placed at exactly opposite ends of the gain medium, facing inward at each other.
Oh, this is the Hall of Mirrors trick.
Exactly. Think about what happens. You fire the pump, the population inversion is achieved, a few electrons spontaneously drop, firing photons in random directions.
And the ones that shoot out the sides of the ruby cylinder just leave the system and are lost.
Right. They produce a little bit of scattered light, but nothing special.
But the photons that happen to be traveling perfectly straight down the central axis of the cylinder.
Those photons hit the mirror at the end. And they bounce back. They travel back through the incredibly excited target-rich gain medium.
Oh, wow.
As they travel, they trigger stimulated emission. One photon becomes two, two become four, four become eight. They reach the opposite mirror, bounce back, and sweep through the medium again. Eight becomes 16, 32, 64.
They are basically acting like a snowplow, bouncing back and forth, plowing through the excited atoms, sweeping up more and more clone photons with every single pass.
It's a brilliant feedback loop. Because the mirrors are perfectly parallel, only the photons that are traveling perfectly straight back and forth survive the journey.
And what happens to the others?
Any photons going at even a slight angle will eventually bounce off the edge and be lost.
So the mirrors don't just amplify the light, they physically align it. They filter out the chaotic directions and enforce the strict discipline of the marching band.
Exactly. The cavity geometry dictates the extreme directional focus of the laser beam. The photons bounce back and forth millions of times in a fraction of a second, building up an unimaginably intense, perfectly coherent, perfectly aligned wave of light between the two mirrors.
But if they're just bouncing back and forth between two mirrors, totally trapped inside the crystal, how do we get the laser beam out?
That is the final elegant trick. The mirror at one end of the cavity is 100% reflective, a perfect mirror. But the mirror at the other end is partially transmissive.
Partially transmissive, meaning what?
It's about 99% reflective and 1% transparent.
Oh, so it lets a tiny fraction of the avalanche leak through.
Exactly. The avalanche builds up to such an intense level of trapped energy that the 1% of light escaping through that partially transparent mirror constitutes an incredibly powerful focused beam.
That escaping 1% is the laser beam you see.
It is.
That is staggering. The beam that can cut through steel or shoot to the moon is just the tiny leakage from an even more violent storm of light trapped inside the machine.
It's harnessing chaos and forcing it into perfect resonant order.
Okay, I really have to know who actually built the first one, because Einstein came up with a math in 1917. But turning that math into mirrors and crystals sounds like an engineering nightmare.
It was a huge challenge. Throughout the 1950s, a lot of very brilliant physicists were racing to build an optical maser. Maser being microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
So they started with microwaves.
Yeah. Right. They had figured out how to do it with invisible microwaves, but doing it with visible light, which has much shorter, faster wavelengths, was considered incredibly difficult. Teams at Bell Labs and Columbia University were working furiously on it.
So who won the race?
An underdog named Theodore Maiman in 1960. He was working at Hughes Research Laboratories in California. And what's fascinating is that Maiman defied the conventional wisdom of all the prominent physicists at the time.
How so? Like, what did he do differently?
Well, the big academic teams were mostly trying to use complex mixtures of gases to create the population inversion. Maiman wanted to use a solid, crystal specifically, synthetic pink ruby.
The ruby laser.
Yes. A lot of experts had published papers claiming that ruby was mathematically unsuitable for achieving a population inversion. They said the energy levels were wrong, that it would absorb too much of its own light.
But Maiman just ignored them.
He ran his own calculations and realized they were wrong. He took a small cylinder of synthetic ruby, polished the ends perfectly flat, and silvered them to act as the mirrors, one fully silvered, one partially silvered.
So he built the optical cavity right onto the crystal itself.
Exactly. Then for the pump, he didn't use some massive continuous electrical discharge. He looked at photography equipment.
Photography.
Yeah. He took a high-power spiral-shaped xenon flash tube, the kind used for high-speed strobe photography, and wrapped it around the ruby cylinder.
So he just hit it with a massive split-second burst of incredibly bright white light.
Right. On May 16th, 1960, Maiman charged up the capacitors, fired the flash lamp, and pulsed that intense white light into the ruby.
And it worked.
The chromium atoms in the ruby absorbed the light, jumped to the excited state, and as they dropped, the stimulated emission bounced back and forth between the silvered ends.
And what actually came out?
A pulse of pure, coherent, deep red light. The first artificial laser beam in human history.
That must have been an incredible moment in the lab. A totally new form of light that didn't exist anywhere in nature.
It was a profound achievement. Maiman actually submitted a short paper detailing his invention to the prestigious journal Physical Review Letters.
Let me guess. They rejected it.
They rejected it.
Why? That's insane.
They thought it was just another incremental update on maser research, and they completely didn't realize the massive paradigm shift of achieving it with visible light.
Ouch.
Yeah. So Maiman ended up publishing it in the British journal Nature, where it was a very brief, roughly 300-word article.
Wow. A 300-word article changed the world. Maybe our 6-word document from today's source isn't so crazy after all.
Brevity can contain multitudes, right? What's really humorous, though, is the public and scientific reaction to the laser in 1960.
How do they react?
Today, we know lasers are the backbone of modern civilization. But when Maiman unveiled it, the press called it a death ray, and the scientific community notoriously dubbed the laser a solution looking for a problem.
A solution looking for a problem. That has to be one of the worst technological predictions of all time.
It's definitely up there. They had invented a way to create perfect, pure, focused light, but they hadn't yet imagined what they could use it for. It was a beautiful piece of physics with no immediate commercial application.
It's hard to even wrap my head around that because today, lasers are literally everywhere. Let's transition into how they are actually used. How do we get from Theodore Maiman's pulsing red ruby to like the barcode scanner at my grocery store or the fiber optic internet cables under the ocean.
To understand the applications, we have to look at how laser technology evolved away from just solid crystals. The ruby laser was a pulsed laser. It fired in short, powerful bursts because the flash tube had to recharge, and the ruby would get too hot if you tried to run it continuously.
Right. If you pump too much energy into a crystal constantly, it's just going to shatter or melt.
Exactly. So the next major breakthrough was the gas laser, specifically the helium neon laser, invented very shortly after Maiman's ruby laser by Ali Javan at Bell Labs.
How is a gas laser different?
Instead of a solid crystal, the gain medium is a glass tube filled with a mixture of helium and neon gases. And instead of a flash lamp, the pump is a continuous electrical current running through the gas, much like a neon sign.
Okay, I can picture that.
The electrical current excites the helium atoms, which then crash into the neon atoms, transferring their energy and pushing the neon into that crucial metastable excited state.
So the population inversion happens in the gas.
Yes. And because it's a gas, it doesn't overheat the same way a crystal does. The helium neon laser could run continuously. It produced a steady, unbroken beam of red light. This is the classic red laser beam you saw in grocery store barcode scanners for decades.
Okay, barcode scanners. That's a perfect example of a problem the laser eventually solved. How exactly does a laser read a barcode? Because to me, it just looks like a solid red line flashing across my cereal box.
It relies entirely on the laser's coherence and tight focus. A barcode is a series of black lines and white spaces. A normal light bulb would just cast a wide wash of light over the whole barcode, and it would be very hard for a sensor to distinguish the sharp edges of the lines.
It would just be a blurry reflection.
Right. But a laser can be focused down to an incredibly tight spot, a fraction of a millimeter wide. The scanner uses rotating mirrors to quickly sweep that tiny laser dot across the barcode.
Ah, so it's not actually a solid line of light at all. It's just a single dot moving incredibly fast.
Exactly. As the tiny dot sweeps across, it hits the white spaces and reflects strongly back into a light sensor in the scanner. When it hits a black line, the black ink absorbs the red laser light and the reflection drops to zero.
So the sensor is just reading a rapid-fire sequence of bright reflection, no reflection, bright reflection, which a computer translates into binary code, ones and zeros.
Perfectly synchronized binary data, enabled solely by the fact that the laser light doesn't spread out and blur the edges.
That is brilliant. It's using light as a highly precise physical probe, which actually reminds me of another massive application: CDs, DVDs, and Blu-ray discs.
Oh, absolutely.
That completely revolutionized how we store information and consume media. I know there's a laser in my old Discman, but how does light read music?
This is where we get into semiconductor lasers, or laser diodes. These are the most common lasers on Earth today. They don't use gas tubes or ruby crystals. They use microscopic chips of semiconductor material, like silicon or gallium arsenide, layered together.
Like a computer chip.
Very similar. By creating a junction between two different types of semiconductor material, one with extra electrons and one with a deficit of electrons called holes, you can pass a tiny electrical current through the chip.
And what does that do?
The electrons and holes recombine at the junction, dropping to a lower energy state and emitting photons.
And if you polish the microscopic edges of the chip to act as mirrors.
You get an optical cavity on a microscopic scale. You get a laser beam coming out of a speck of material the size of a grain of salt.
That is insane. A microscopic marching band.
And because they are so small and require so little power, they could be put inside consumer electronics. So let's look at a CD. The surface of a CD is not smooth. If you looked at it under a microscope, it is a long, continuous spiral track of microscopic bumps and flat areas. We call them pits and lands.
It's like a microscopic vinyl record, but instead of a physical needle tracing the grooves, it's a laser.
Exactly. The laser diode shines a focused beam onto the spinning disk. When the laser hits a flat land, the light reflects perfectly straight back into a sensor.
Makes sense.
But when it hits a pit, the depth of the pit is engineered to be exactly one quarter the wavelength of the laser light.
One quarter the wavelength, why is that specific math important?
Because of interference. When the light hits the pit, the light has to travel slightly further down to the bottom of the pit and back up. The total extra distance it travels is one half of a wavelength, a quarter down, a quarter back.
So the light bouncing out of the pit is now exactly half a wavelength out of sync with the light bouncing off the flat surface next to it.
Yes. And what happens when the peak of one wave aligns with the trough of another wave?
They cancel each other out. just like the kids in the wave pool jumping perfectly out of sync to flatten the water.
It's called destructive interference. So as the CD spins, the laser reflects brightly off the lens, but when it hits the edge of a pit, the interference causes the light intensity to drop sharply. The sensor reads these rapid changes in light intensity as ones and zeros, digital audio.
That is an incredibly elegant use of quantum mechanics just to listen to the Backstreet Boys in 1999.
It really is. And the evolution of that technology shows why wavelength matters so much. CDs used infrared lasers, which have relatively long wavelengths.
Which means the pits had to be relatively large so the laser could actually feel them.
Right. A laser can't focus on something smaller than its own wavelength. It would be like trying to read Braille with an oven mitt. So a CD can hold about 700 megabytes of data. But in the 1990s, scientists figured out how to make laser diodes that emitted red light, which has a shorter wavelength than infrared.
And shorter wavelength means a smaller, sharper optical needle.
Exactly. With a red laser, they could make the pit smaller and pack the spiral track much tighter. The CD became the DVD, holding 4.7 gigabytes.
A massive jump in storage just by changing the color of the light.
And the holy grail was the blue laser. Blue light has a much shorter wavelength than red, but building a blue laser diode was notoriously difficult. It took decades of material science to figure out how to grow gallium nitride crystals perfectly enough to lase in the blue spectrum. Shuji Nakamura won the Nobel Prize for finally cracking it in the 1990s.
And a blue laser means even smaller pits.
Microscopic pits. That allowed for the Blu-ray disc, which holds 25 to 50 gigabytes, all driven by the quest for shorter and shorter coherent wavelengths.
It's fascinating how the physical property of the light wave dictates the limit of the technology. But data storage on disks is almost obsolete now, right? We stream everything. Which brings us to the internet. None of this streaming works without lasers, does it? Fiber optics.
Fiber optics is arguably the most vital application of the laser in human history. The entire backbone of the global internet is built on it.
How does that work? I know fiber optics are basically just really long, thin tubes of glass. How does shooting a laser down a glass tube connect me to a server in Japan?
It works on a principle called total internal reflection. If you shine a light into a pane of glass at a shallow enough angle, the light doesn't pass through the glass. It reflects off the inside surface as if it were a perfect mirror.
Oh, like when you were underwater in a swimming pool and you look up the surface from a sharp angle, it looks like a silver mirror.
Exactly. An optical fiber is a strand of glass, incredibly pure and incredibly thin, about the diameter of a human hair. You take an infrared laser diode and you pulse it on and off billions of times per second.
Translating internet data, emails, videos, video calls into flashes of light.
Those flashes of coherent light enter the glass fiber. Because the light is coherent and directional, it travels in a tight beam. When it hits the curve of the fiber, it hits at a shallow angle, perfectly reflecting off the inside walls, bouncing its way down the cable at the speed of light.
Literally the speed of light.
Because the glass is so pure, far purer than window glass, the light can travel for dozens of miles before it starts to fade and needs to be amplified. We have massive bundles of these glass hairs wrapped in steel cables laid across the bottom of the ocean floors connecting the continents. Millions of lasers flashing billions of times a second, carrying all the data of humanity.
It's mind-boggling. We took Mayman's pulsing red crystal and turned it into a nervous system for the entire planet. But all of these applications we've talked about, scanners, CDs, fiber optics, they use very low-power lasers. They're just reading or transmitting data.
Mm-hmm.
What about when lasers are used as brute force tools?
Like what?
Well, I've seen videos of lasers cutting through thick sheets of steel in car factories. How does light slice metal?
That requires a completely different scale of power. For industrial cutting, we often use carbon dioxide or CO2 lasers or high-power solid-state fiber lasers.
A carbon dioxide laser?
Yes. The gain medium is a mixture of gases, primarily CO2. When pumped with electricity, the CO2 molecules vibrate and achieve a population inversion, emitting an incredibly intense beam of infrared light. This isn't milliwatts of power like a laser pointer. We are talking kilowatts of continuous optical power.
Wow. So when you focus a kilowatt of infrared light onto a sheet of steel, what actually happens at the atomic level? Is it just melting the steel?
It's melting it and often vaporizing it. The laser is focused by a lens down to a pinpoint on the surface of the metal. Because the light is coherent, all that energy is concentrated into an infinitely small area. The metal absorbs the intense infrared radiation. The atoms in the steel begin to vibrate violently.
And heat is just atomic vibration.
Exactly. The localized heat spikes thousands of degrees in a fraction of a second. The steel instantly melts, and the center of the focal point actually boils into a vapor. Usually, there is a high-pressure jet of assist gas like oxygen or nitrogen blowing coaxially with the laser beam.
So it's pushing the metal out of the way.
This gas physically blows the molten metal out of the cut zone, leaving a perfectly clean, razor-sharp edge.
It's essentially a lightsaber, but industrialized.
It is. It's touchless machining. There's no saw blade to dull, no physical pressure to warp the metal. You can program a computer to steer the beam and cut incredibly intricate shapes out of titanium, steel, or Kevlar with microscopic precision.
That precision makes me think of medicine. Because we don't just cut steel with lasers, we cut human tissue. Which sounds terrifying when you consider what you just described with boiling metal. How do you use a laser on someone's eye without blinding them?
Medical lasers are a perfect example of tuning the tool to the tissue. You wouldn't use a continuous high-power CO2 laser for delicate eye surgery. It causes way too much thermal damage to surrounding cells. The heat conducts outward and burns the tissue.
Right. You definitely don't want a burn scar on your cornea.
So for something like LASIK eye surgery, where we want to reshape the cornea to fix nearsightedness, we use an
How?
excimer laser.
Excimer. What does that mean?
It stands for excited dimer. It uses a mixture of reactive gases like argon and fluorine, which only bond together when they are electrically excited. When they drop back down to the ground state, the molecule falls apart and emits a photon in the ultraviolet spectrum.
Ultraviolet light, not infrared like the cutting lasers. Why is that distinction important?
Because ultraviolet light has a very short wavelength and incredibly high photon energy, it interacts with organic tissue in a fundamentally different way than infrared light. Infrared heats things up by making molecules vibrate. Ultraviolet photons carry so much raw energy that when they hit a biological molecule, they don't heat it. They literally shatter the carbon-carbon molecular bonds.
They break the chemistry of the cell itself.
Exactly. It's a process called photoablation. The laser pulse hits the surface of the cornea, the molecular bonds snap, and the microscopic layer of tissue instantly turns into a gas and floats away. There is almost zero heat transfer to the cells underneath.
So it's a cold cut.
A cold, perfectly precise cut. The excimer laser pulses hundreds of times a second, vaporizing microscopic layers of cells one by one, slowly sculpting the curvature of the cornea until the eye can focus perfectly. The precision is less than a fraction of a human hair.
It's astonishing. We're using the quantum mechanics of stimulated emission to perform molecular level surgery on the human eye.
And we are continually finding new ways to apply this precision. The future of lasers is moving into realms that honestly sound like science fiction.
Oh, give me a preview. Where's the technology going next? We've got communications, cutting, surgery. What's the next frontier?
One major frontier is nuclear fusion, the quest for clean, limitless energy.
Using lasers to create a star on Earth.
Essentially, yes. At the National Ignition Facility in California, they use the largest, most energetic laser system in the world. It's a building the size of three football fields. They take a single weak infrared laser pulse and split it into 192 separate beams. They run those beams through miles of glass amplifiers, boosting their energy exponentially.
Creating a massive synchronized army of photons.
They convert those beams into ultraviolet light and focus all 192 beams simultaneously onto a target the size of a peppercorn. Inside that peppercorn is frozen hydrogen fuel.
What happens when 192 stadium-sized lasers hit a peppercorn at exactly the same time?
The outer surface of the capsule instantly explodes outward. According to Newton's third law, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The rest of the capsule is violently driven inward. The implosion compresses the hydrogen fuel to densities 100 times greater than lead, heating it to millions of degrees.
The exact conditions inside the core of the sun.
The hydrogen atoms are forced together, they fuse into helium and release a massive burst of clean nuclear energy. They recently achieved ignition, where the reaction produced more energy than the lasers pumped into it. It's a crucial first step toward limitless clean energy, and it relies entirely on the perfect synchronization of laser light.
That is just incredible, the scale of it, from a peppercorn to three football fields of amplifiers.
On the other end of the spectrum, lasers are driving the future of autonomous vehicles. LIDAR technology.
LIDAR, like radar, but with light.
Exactly. Light detection and ranging. Self-driving cars have LIDAR units spinning on their roofs. They shoot out millions of invisible infrared laser pulses every second in a 360-degree arc. Those pulses hit cars, pedestrians, trees, and road signs and bounce back to a sensor.
And because light travels at a constant speed, the computer can calculate exactly how long the pulse took to bounce back.
Right. It measures the time of flight of the photon. By doing this millions of times a second, the car builds a perfect real-time 3D map of the world around it with millimeter precision. It sees the world purely through laser reflection.
It's giving machines the ability to see in high definition.
And finally, space communication. Right now, we communicate with satellites and rovers using radio waves. But radio waves spread out and carry relatively low amounts of data. NASA is aggressively testing optical communications, using lasers to transmit data across the solar system.
Because the laser beam stays tightly focused even over millions of miles.
Yes. A laser beam fired from Mars would spread out a little bit by the time it reaches Earth, but it's vastly more focused than a radio wave. And because the frequency of light is so much higher than radio, you can pack exponentially more data into a laser beam. We will be able to stream high-definition video live from astronauts on Mars directly back to Earth using interplanetary fiber optics without the fiber.
Just a coherent beam of photons cutting through the vacuum of space.
It's a long way from a red light blinking in a ruby crystal in 1960.
It really is. We've gone from Niels Bohr's atomic ladders to Einstein's stimulated emission to Theodore Maiman's ruby flash tube to fiber optic internets, molecular eye surgery, and now interplanetary communication. And all of it, literally all of it, hinges on the simple quantum mechanic trick of making one photon clone itself perfectly.
The mastery of coherence, taking the chaotic nature of the universe and forcing it into perfect synchronized order.
Which, honestly, brings me back to the document sitting on the desk between us. The absolute minimalist joke that you, the listener, sent in for this deep dive. Excerpts from How Lasers Work. How lasers work.
It's a very productive provocation, I have to say.
It really was. We could have looked at this 6-word document, laughed, and thrown it in the trash. We could have spent an hour trying to analyze the font or the margins. But instead, we took the bait. The document pointed out a gap, and we spent this time filling it. We built the rest of the excerpt.
It highlights something fundamental about why we bother trying to learn these dense subjects in the first place. The hunger for knowledge is activated by the realization of ignorance.
Exactly. Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought. We spent this whole time diving into the staggering mechanics of quantum physics and optical engineering. But the deep dive is coming to a close.
And the mechanism of the text remains.
Yes. So, here is something for you to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. Consider the power of a title standing completely on its own. How does the mere isolated phrase, "how lasers work," instantly trigger your brain to realize there's a gap in your own knowledge?
The title acts as a mirror, reflecting your own lack of understanding back at you.
Perhaps the true value of a source that provides absolutely no answers is that it compels you, independently and freely, to seek out the rest of the excerpts on your own. It forces you to build the cathedral yourself. So until next time, keep looking for those missing pages, keep interrogating the silences, and keep exploring the map, even when the paper is completely blank. We will catch you on the next deep dive.